It's the unknown. Unknown. It's the unknown. Unknown creature.
Beautiful people, Uncle Zoe in the building, aka the Unknown Preacher, aka LA, and the super duper Tatiana. What's up, Tati? Oh, and Micah. Hey, Micah.
Yeah, Micah's over here. I'm bribing him with snacks so that he hopefully does not get cranky and start complaining while we're recording. So we'll see.
That's what's up, man. That's what's up.
You I am put the logo in the middle.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Boy, that's what I'm saying. It's never a one-man show on the Unknown Preacher LA.
Yeah.
It's a team thing. Yeah. How are you?
You know, I feel really good about myself today because I just feel like I really balanced everything that I had on my agenda really well today. And I feel really good about that. So. And I also, you know, this week was Veterans Day and I took the day to get myself a body treatment, which is like where they exfoliate your whole body and hydrate it. So I just feel like really, like my skin feels really good.
Feels good.
Yeah, and I had a massage. Yeah, good stuff.
So you just bragging now. I've been like James Evans with my head barely above water with Taz this week, but
Tuesday was holiday. Did you not have a day off?
No, there's never a day off. No.
Oh, well, that's no. Unfortunate for you because I definitely said, let me utilize this day off. And I almost, my remote job was talking about sending some people, they send people the last few years to COP, the like global convening where people get together to talk about like climate change and the climate goals. Mm-hmm. And they always send a few people and ask, like, do we want to go? And I typically always say no, and I don't even throw my name into the ring. This year, I threw my name into the ring only because they were going to Brazil, and it's been a goal of mine to go to Brazil for, like, over a decade.
Wow.
And then they didn't even choose me. I'm like, well, I'm never signing up again, for the record. Like, okay, y'all had me throw my name in the ring. Then the one time I throw my name in the ring, you didn't even choose me. But anyway, I would have been in Brazil and over that holiday. But as soon as they said they weren't choosing me, I said, "I'm okay, cool. I'm going to make that a spa day. Thank you."
That's what's up.
Yeah.
Have to take care of yourself, man. But no, I've been working and managing and giving advice. People have been talking about bullies in the workplace and trying to address stuff like that, man, you know?
Okay, I won't ask about that on air, even though.
Nah, we won't get in. It's not my workplace. It's their workplace. So it'll be harder to connect the dots. But just, you know, bullies is kind of a pet peeve of mine, you know?
For sure.
Yeah. I was bullied one time in the first grade. I can't even remember her name, but yeah, she was like really tall.
Did it have something to do with a pencil?
No, that was the girl I had a crush on. Boy, you got a memory. Yeah, no, I saved her pencil for the whole summer. From first grade, the summer after first grade, I saved the pencil she lent me and I was looking so forward to giving it to her second grade. And then I moved out of the housing community to another side of town. And so I ended up going to another elementary school. So, yep. But anyway.
Romantic.
Huh?
I said you're a hopeless romantic.
Imagine this. She could be your best friend, your sister, your coworker. She could even be you. On the outside, she looks like she has it all together. A nice home, a polished smile, maybe even the dream job. But behind closed doors, silence is her survival. That silence helps no one. 1 in 4 women will face abuse in her lifetime. And while some forms of abuse are easy to spot, others hide in plain sight. Behind wealth, success, and respectability, it's called upscale abuse. In John and Susie One Woman in Fours and Susie, author Kelly Jones pulls back the curtain on traditional and upscale abuse with raw stories, urgent insights, and practical tools. She introduces the powerful BOSS framework, showing how abusers choose, trap, and control their victims. More importantly, she gives survivors and allies the clarity and courage to recognize danger before it's too late. John and Susie isn't just awareness. It's a call to action. It shows how abuse ripples beyond the victim to children, families, friends, even bystanders. And it gives us all the tools to respond with compassion and safety. John and Susie, One Woman Enforces Susie by Kelly Jones, is available on Amazon. Awareness is the first step. Action is the next step. Don't wait.
No, I'm going back to the bully. You're the one that got into my, you know.
Well, but, I was just confusing the stories.
Oh, okay. All right. Gotcha. No, so the bully, I was venting to my Aunt Helen, who she was like really like a second mother to me. She was like, stand up to a bully and watch her shut down. And I was like, but she's bigger than me. And she was like, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And so one time I did push a girl, y'all, but we were in the first grade. But anyway, I pushed her and she fell down and started crying. And it was like this Disney movie because all the kids started, you know, surrounding me and picking me up and, you know, patting me on the head and saying, you did it. You got her. So I just assumed she was swimming. Yeah.
She must have been a menace to society. People,
I was just going to say that. Yeah, I didn't know. I mean, all I know is my experience with her, but looking back now. But yeah, so ever since then, you know, I just remember what my Aunt Helen said and just said, no, nah, I'm going to stand up to bullies, you know? But yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good philosophy to have.
Yes.
Or a good way of being, standing up to bullies. But don't be pushing on girls no more, though.
Oh, no, not now. You know, at that age, though, girls are actually usually bigger than boys anyway. Y'all can beat us up.
How old did you say you were in this story?
I was like 6 or 7.
Oh, okay. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, but I was thinking about something when I was thinking about the episode and putting things together, and I was going to use a post, as I said before we started, and I was like, man, we send each other posts and debate about them. We could have a whole episode about social media posts.
We could. There's way too many. That would be, I don't know, that would be a lot of content because it's a lot of them. Well, just before we got on, I was like, it's 3 more posts that I sent you that you haven't opened yet, so...
Yeah.
And that's a slow day because usually I'm like, hey, there's 11 messages, there's 11 posts I sent you that you haven't opened yet. Only 3? That's because I was busy today with my work. I was too busy. I didn't have a lot of time to be sending posts. So usually it's more.
Yeah, see? But well, like you would just pick 3 really good ones and then you could have an entire episode.
Yeah, there are some that are deeper than others. And sometimes I'm just sending stuff because I'm like, oh, this is funny, or this will be a cute little laugh or a cute little smile. And others I'm sending where it's like, this is something to talk about.
Yep, exactly. And then sometimes, you know, I debate for the sake of debating.
And let's exclude any of those, because yes, you do, and I don't want to do any of those ones.
Oh, man. But no, you sent one, and I really struggled. You and I talked a little bit about it. I was like, I don't want to be that guy, because I totally disagreed with the post, and then I said, I'm struggling whether to talk about it, you know, because I'm really big on people doing their thing. And I think I said a few episodes back, spiritual apartheid, you know, I'm totally against that. And so when people express something that doesn't necessarily follow the doctrine I follow, I try to respect that. But then I started thinking about the dangers behind it when you follow, because this person is a celebrity, they have a huge following. And then but then I backed out again, and then you called me weak or soft, and then I said, well, let me revisit that again.
I never called you weak or soft. I just said, because you were like, I said, you said that there was an obligation of people who know the Bible to sort of
put out the factual side of things and not necessarily what the, like, to counter what the one person said. And so I was like, okay, well, then go ahead and do it. And he like, I'm going to pray about it. So I just, all I said was, what happened to obligation? Because if it's a spiritual obligation, you don't need to pray about it. You already know what you got to do. That's all I said.
Okay, okay.
And I stand by that.
You always got to pull the exact words when I'm trying to, like, sprinkle a little entertainment to a statement, you know?
Okay, entertain about somebody else's stuff. Don't entertain the on me.
Exaggeration's good sometimes. No, I'm just playing.
Exaggerate on somebody else, yeah.
All right, so I'm going to play this. Should I even say her name? I don't even have to say her name.
People will know the voice if they
okay, do this. I don't want to say her. All right, so here we go.
I've questioned you because you
no, I'm going back to the bully. You the one that got into my, you know.
Well, but, I was just confusing the stories.
Oh, okay. All right. Gotcha. No, so the bully, I was venting to my Aunt Helen, who she was like really like a second mother to me. She was like, stand up to a bully and watch her shut down. And I was like, but she's bigger than me. And she was like, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. And so one time I did push a girl, y'all, but we were in the first grade. But anyway, I pushed her and she fell down and started crying. And it was like this Disney movie because all the kids started, you know, surrounding me and picking me up and, you know, patting me on the head and saying, you did it. You got her. So I just assumed she was swimming. Yeah.
She must have been a menace to society. People,
I was just going to say that. Yeah, I didn't know. I mean, all I know is my experience with her, but looking back now. But yeah, so ever since then, you know, I just remember what my Aunt Helen said and just said, no, I'm going to stand up to bullies, you know? But yeah.
Well, that's a good philosophy to have.
Yes.
Or a good way of being, standing up to bullies. But don't be pushing on girls no more, though.
Oh, no, not now. You know, at that age, though, girls are actually usually bigger than boys anyway. Y'all can beat us up.
How old did you say you were in this story?
I was like 6 or 7.
Okay. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, but I was thinking about something when I was thinking about the episode and putting things together, and I was going to use a post, as I said before we started, and I was like, man, we've seen each other post and debate about them. We could have a whole episode about social media posts.
We could. There's way too many. That would be, I don't know, that would be a lot of content because it's a lot of them. Just before we got on, I was like, there's 3 more posts that I sent you that you haven't opened yet, so...
Yeah.
And that's a slow day because usually I'm like, hey, there's 11 messages, there's 11 posts I sent you that you haven't opened yet. Only 3? That's because I was busy today with my work. I was too busy. I didn't have a lot of time to be sending posts. So usually it's more.
Yeah, see? But, well, like, you would just pick 3 really good ones and then you could have an entire episode.
Yeah, there are some that are deeper than others. And sometimes I'm just sending stuff to my like, oh, this is funny, or this will be a cute little laugh or a cute little smile. And others I'm sending where it's like, this is something to talk about.
Yep, exactly. And then sometimes, you know, I debate for the sake of debating.
And let's exclude any of those, because yes, you do, and I don't want to do any of those ones.
Oh, man. But no, you sent one, and I really struggled. You and I talked a little bit about it. I was like, I don't want to be that guy, because I totally disagreed with the post, and then I said, I'm struggling whether to talk about it, you know, because I'm really big on people doing their thing. And I think I said a few episodes back, spiritual apartheid, you know, I'm totally against that. And so when people express something that doesn't necessarily follow the doctrine I follow, I try to respect that. But then I started thinking about the dangers behind it when you follow, because this person is a celebrity, they have a huge following. And then, but then I backed out again, and then you called me weak or soft, and then I said, well, let me revisit that again.
I never called you weak or soft. I just said, because you were like, I said, you said that there was an obligation of people who know people who know the Bible to sort of put out the factual side of things and not necessarily what the, like, to counter what the one person said. And so I was like, okay, well then go ahead and do it. And he's like, I'm going to pray about it. So I just, all I said was, what happened to obligation? Because if it's a spiritual obligation, you don't need to pray about it. You already know what you got to do. That's all I said.
Okay, okay.
And I stand by it.
Y'all always got to pull the exact words when I'm trying to, like, sprinkle a little entertainment to a statement, you know?
Okay, entertain about somebody else's stuff. Don't entertain the on me.
Exaggeration's good sometimes. No, I'm just playing.
Exaggerate somebody else, yeah.
All right, so I'm going to play this. Should I even say her name? I don't even have to say her name.
People will know the voice if they
okay, do this.
Well, I don't want to
say her. All right, so here we go.
Have questioned you because you communicate with mediums or psychics and, you know, and you know the things. Why can we not have a connection?
I don't know, but I call myself a liberal Christian.
Tell me what that means.
That just means that it's not anything that I am stuck to. You know what I mean? Like, I believe in God. I believe in Jesus. And I believe he died for my sins. I don't read the Bible anymore.
Wait a minute.
I feel like the Bible is, I'm just saying it's a guideline. So I don't have to go and, you know, just read the Bible. I go to the Bible for stories. I go to the Bible for, if I want to, like, read the Bible.
Wow. Do you have an opinion?
I mean, it's hard for me to have an opinion because, at least not on the content of what was said, because I mean, from my perspective, she's just speaking on what she does. So she's just saying, like, this is what I do. You know, this is how I see it or how I do things and how I frame my own practices. And so what's for me to say about that? I think the person who she was talking to definitely had a pick because they said, wait a minute, hold up, wait a minute. But, like, you know, I don't really, and in terms of just the idea of, I mean, okay, is the question what is my opinion on what she said, or is the question what is my opinion on trying to commune with the other side?
So, in the spirit of safety, no, I'm just playing. Really just, and I can just tell you, flat out, it's witchcraft. I mean, that's really what that is, sorcery. The Bible speaks clearly against it. So, but yeah, on her reaching out to mediums and what was the other thing? Psychics. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, you quanky baby. Yeah, again, I mean, her choice to do that is, you know, she can do whatever she want to do, I guess. Like,
yeah,
you know, and like I said, when we talked about it, she wasn't really... Hold on here.
So, I remember, now you made me think of something else. I forgot. Did I say misinformed? Or I say she's giving out misinformation. I think that's what I said. And you pushed back on that, I think. I can't remember. But I think I landed on she's misinformed. I think that's what it was.
You said I did push back on misinformation because she never said what was a fact. She never said what is true. She just said what she does and what her practice is and how she sees things. So that's why I'm like, it's not really misinformation for her to say what she does and what she believes. And then I think where you landed was, I think you landed on misguided.
Okay. All right. See, boy, you remember better than I do what I said. Thank you. Yeah, I did. But then the other part about when she said liberal Christianity or liberal Christian, you know,
yeah.
And the concept sounds cool and, you know, appealing, but I think I give pushback on a whole lot of that when you say, I don't even look at the Bible, because basically Well, then she countered and said, well, I read stories from the Bible, but you basically, what's your guide? What are you using to guide you? And you're focusing on feelings now. I feel good about this person. The other argument is, because you could argue that now you have this pass to do whatever you want, and that it's never been designed, that's never been God's intent. But if you follow that philosophy, do whatever. and dabbling into witchcraft or going to mediums, or you're taking shortcuts. And sometimes God hides things for us for a reason. Sometimes there's a journey we have to go down before we're exposed to certain things or afforded certain things. So I just think that it's, I don't even know, I would say a slippery slope, but for most Christians who really understand the word and what Jesus is saying, it's not even a slippery slope. It's a hard, solid red line.
Yeah. Okay, now that I have separated myself from the noise here. Okay, I'm going to say something that I honestly hadn't thought about it really before this moment.
Don't get it kicked off of Radio 1.
No, we're not going to get kicked. I don't think so.
I'm playing.
But, I mean, we'll see what happens. And as I commonly say when I'm on here, if you want to edit something out, people have probably heard me say this many times that before I get ready.
Yeah, because I don't edit it out.
You never do. But it's two sides of this, and I never come at it really with a biblical perspective, so that's not what I'm about to give. It's two sides of this to me. The one, when I'm thinking about the idea of using mediums or just trying to communicate with the other side. On the one hand, I feel like it's kind of scary to like dabble into that because like I just don't know. Like you might tap into something that's not necessarily what you intended to tap into. Mm-hmm. Like you just might end up somewhere that's not really where you were trying to go. And it just might be, I don't know. It just might be something dangerous that you wish that you hadn't interacted with, or that you woke something up that maybe you weren't supposed to be waking up. So like on the one hand, I'm like, from a logical perspective, I would probably avoid that practice.
Yeah.
But that's with my logical brain.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm thinking with my emotional brain, I have to think about the times where I have lost people. Like, I lost my brother in 2019, and it was the first time that I was ever really deeply upset about a death.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself, if I could find some kind of hoodoo witch, somebody who could bring my brother back, I would absolutely do it. I thought this. I was like, if there is somebody, some witch doctor in another country somewhere and high in the mountain, hidden in the cave, that knows how to do something that could bring my brother back, I would do it. Mm-hmm. And then I lost my daughter in 2023. Yeah. And like, I just think, so then I'm like, if I'm thinking with my emotional brain, I might not necessarily make good decisions as it relates to doing something like dangerous that maybe if I was thinking with my logical brain, I would stay away from that kind of practice. When I'm thinking my emotional brain, I don't know who she's trying to communicate with when she's going to mediums and all of this, but I know that if I was presented that choice and it was about my brother or my daughter, I might do something that I wouldn't do if it was somebody else, because I wouldn't be thinking with my logical brain. And so I can kind of understand how you might be tempted to engage in something that's probably not in general an activity that you, because oftentimes if we lead with our emotional brain, or if we even lead with sometimes our flesh, or lead with anything that's not just you thinking rationally, you might make decisions that are not necessarily sound decisions. Because even if I were to do that, if I was to find this witch doctor and do this thing to bring my brother back, that could actually, who knows what unintended consequences might come from that I wouldn't be thinking of with, you know, my emotional brain. So I don't know, like, I don't know who she's, I don't know what her purpose is or who she's, but in general, I don't just have a random desire to speak to the other side. And in terms of the psychic piece, I mean, I've never endeavored to, I don't know, like a psychic. I don't know that I would trust anybody who said that they were a psychic.
Yeah.
If I really, truly knew that it was really, really the future, I probably would be like, okay, am I going to get married at all? If so, when am I going to get married? If I knew that the answer was really, really real. But again, thinking with my logical brain, I don't think I would ever really believe that anybody was really going to give me a real answer to that. Like, I don't think even if somebody tried to give me a prediction, I would actually believe it to be true. So like, yeah.
That's deep, man. See, that's probably the most profound thing I heard all week, seriously. The emotion piece, because those are two significant losses. And I will tell you, I love what you said about the emotion piece and the honesty, because if you're running to a psychic, let's be real, usually it is out of desperation. You're looking for an answer. If you're a Christian and you run to a psychic, you've been waiting on something from God, and you feel more often than not that God is silent. And so you run to this psychic, you get those answers because you're desperate. But how do I put it? Desperation can lead to disobedience, but when you, and that's why she said two things that I don't know if people connected the dots in. She said, number one, that she goes to psychics and mediums, but number two, she doesn't read the Bible. Mm-hmm. And so because you're not reading the Bible, because you're not grounded in the truth, because you're not doing that, you're more likely, that's where the strength and the wisdom comes from. And so when we're unstable, when we have those moments, and I would never compare my losses to anyone else's, because I lost my mom and dad in that same period, but it's different. You know, that's nature. Losing your mom and dad, you're supposed to. That's, you know, losing a brother, losing a child is nature in reverse. Mm-hmm. So you can't compare that by any means. But staying grounded and, you know, just... that's what I was going to say. I lost my train of thought. You didn't do it, though. You thought about it. That's the other piece. So
the opportunity wasn't really presented to me, though.
Yeah, if you really, the Tatiana I know, if she really wanted to make that happen, she would have been. There's a psychic on about every corner in the major cities, man.
I wouldn't trust them to be real.
But I'm just saying, that's my point. You know, we're human. We're going to have thoughts. We're going to, yeah. You know, but... actually going through the actions. And I didn't really want to knock the celebrity. My main point was for those who listen, because we do have a lot of listeners. I know, because some have told me, I don't go to church. I don't read the Bible. I don't really follow the word. And so when they hear, you know, you're more likely to say, hey, she's doing it. Let me try this out. And so that was really why I said, well, or I struggled and then said, yeah, let's go ahead and do it, because you don't want to lead people astray. And because what they say, that the blind leading the blind, you're misguided. And now you have followers, because you have a lot of followers. Now they're misguided.
Yeah, I guess anybody who's hearing my voice right now, don't go to random celebrities on the internet for your spiritual advice or guidance. Like, I would not encourage that as a practice, regardless of who it is. So, like, I think that people have the right to their life choices, and you have the right to speak on your life choices. You know, if I were to say the same thing on my platform, even though I only have a few hundred followers and my page is just private because I don't want random people looking at what I'm saying or doing in my life. Like, or if I am somebody who has, I don't know how many followers she has, 2 million or whatever, like, it's still my platform to share my life. And so if that's her life and perspective, feel free to share that. But anybody who's hearing my voice right now, if you see this, that is not just because somebody else is doing something in their life. That is not your cue to follow their lead. Like, that is just not, I just wouldn't encourage that for anybody. Like, come to your own understandings of things, yeah, and do your own interrogation or prayer or meditation or whatever sitting with mm-hmm. it that you have to do to come to where you're going to come to. Yeah. But don't just randomly follow somebody who says something on social media.
Yeah.
That's just not the way that it is. Even if you think that it's the person that you follow, a lot of times it's random made up clips of people's faces. It's not even necessarily them. Like, that's, let's just not make a practice of doing things because we heard somebody say it in the clip on the internet. Let's just not.
Amen. Amen. I'll say this last piece because I was just, as you were talking, I was thinking about it. So 4 years as a police officer, I'm a beat officer. I make a comment. I'm going to be the chief of police one day. Mm-hmm. And you put in work, you do things, and then you see this coming to fruition. So just imagine this psychic tells you, here's my goal. Yeah, I see you. You're going to do it in 10 years. What what path would you take then? You know, there's a reason why God, why things aren't revealed, because there's work that you put in. There's commitment. That's a learning process. And then there's trials. And so you're going to miss out on all of this through this journey, because really life really is a journey. So you're going to miss out on all this, and you may not get the position, but or whatever you're trying to gain, you may not get it. But if you do, you're not in a better place because of it. There's growth, there's development, there's a whole lot of things that you're trying to skip. You're taking a shortcut. And I'll leave it at that. Are you frowning?
Because you okay with AI for music shortcuts, but you're not okay with it.
I didn't say I was okay with AI music shortcut. I didn't say okay. For you to quote words all the time, you misquoted me this time. What I said was, I'm not a big fan of this person's work. However, I didn't see anything wrong with it. And I talked about
the evolution of music. How is not seeing anything wrong, not the same as being okay?
I talked about the evolution of music and how there are things that went on back. Don't frown, like, you know I said that. I talked about live band musicians being in the studio and being replaced by a sound machine. I said there's an evolution of music. Don't do that, man. Don't do that.
Okay, I'm
done. We're going to have a whole nother episode about that.
I'm not doing an episode with you on that. I'm not doing it. I refuse.
Okay. But the listeners would love it.
Too bad.
Uh-huh. Hey, I do want to get on a serious note, because this is a really good. When I tell you, someone talked about this book, I said, called Morningside, and they let me read it. And when I tell you, I've read a lot of books in the past few years. This book moved me like very few books have. Just the insight from the author, the way he was able to merge storytelling with historical facts. It was just very impactful. And so after I read it, I said, let me search for this guy on social media. And man, I love it. I reached out to him and we connected. He agreed to come on. The book is Morningside. His name is Aaron Shetterly. And it's about the Greensboro Massacre. And this occurred in 1979. There was a march taking place. The Ku Klux Klan in broad daylight, they show up. There's a shootout that takes place. 5 people are killed. And it's all filmed because the media was there to cover the march. And so I'm just so looking forward to this interview. T, when Aaron comes on, anything you want me to ask him? And what are your thoughts?
You said, what are my thoughts?
Yeah, thoughts about what I just described, the book, the author, the event.
Well, I mean, you told me about this person coming on a few weeks ago, and I meant to read the book before today's episode, so I regret that I didn't get a chance to do that. but it's still on my to read list. And just hearing you talk about how it moved you really, really makes me want to read even more. I love reading, you know, Black history and stuff like that. And I like what you just described about how it's a mixture of storytelling with that. I can think of some good historical books that read in that fashion that I've enjoyed. And so hearing that makes me even more excited about reading it when I do get a chance. Very curious to hear about the author's writing process and just like what his methods were for doing research in the book. I was actually kind of thinking about like maybe doing a book here soon, and so I was really curious to hear about like what was his process of doing the research for this book. And I also, just in looking up his profile, noticed that there was quite a bit of time in between his first book and his second book, so I'm also curious just like how much time he invested, you know, in the writing process. Did he spend actually a really long time on the research and the writing of this book, or is it just that maybe he had taken a break from writing and then came up with this idea and decided to come back and do another book? So I'm curious about that, and if he has any other books kind of in the pipeline that are coming forward, and maybe even just what he perhaps learned about himself as he engaged with the writing and research process for this book. So I'm really excited to hear about that. I might have to, like, I hope that there's no spoilers though in those answers, because I do still really, really want to read the book.
Man, those are some great questions. I've been excited about a lot of interviews, but I'm really excited about this one. And so thank you, T, as always, for being the ride or die that you are and sharing your wisdom. Your boy appreciates you.
Yay. Thank you. I always love coming on.
Yes, yes.
Even when you sass me.
Proverbs 21:5 tells us, if you plan and work hard, you will have plenty. Yet for many, money feels stressful and overwhelming. If you're tired of worrying about bills and debt, there's a better way. Kiera Speed, a financial coach, helps individuals and families walk in wisdom and peace with their money. And she can help you build a plan that aligns with your spiritual values and also helps you feel empowered with your money so that you can save, pay down debt, and build wealth for you and your family. Interested in learning more? Visit moneyempowered.com to schedule your free 60-minute consultation.
We're back, beautiful people. And before we get into the specifics, I want to put this out there for our listeners who never heard of the Greensboro Massacre of 1979. And basically, there were like 5 people killed in this incident. It was caught on camera. No one was convicted. And thank God for our guest and the work he's done on this story. The book is Morningside, and it tells the story of November 3rd, 1979, shooting in Morningside homes. And this was, I think it was a housing community in Greensboro, North Carolina. And on that date, the Death to the Klan march was met by armed members of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party. And 5 people were killed, many more wounded. And what I love about this book, and he focused on a lot of things, but there was a focus on Nelson Johnson and his wife, Joyce Johnson. So we'll hear more about that. But my guest today had the courage. I got to say that again, the courage and conviction to tell this story. He committed to tons of research, interviews. He reviewed police documents. I mean, put in a lot of work. And what an amazing story and a journey putting this all together. And I really, really, really dug into those final chapters too. He was able to take this incident and humanize the story. So ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, welcome Aaron Shetterly to The Unknown Preacher. How you doing, Aaron? How are you?
It's great to be here with you. Thank you so much for having me on to talk about this book.
Yeah, I am just so honored to have you on the show. But before we get into the history of this, tell us about yourself and what first drew you to the story of the Greensboro Massacre. For like, What made this a story you had to tell?
Great question. I was in Greensboro, North Carolina in 2015. My father's a painter, and he had a show of his portraits at the Civil Rights Center Museum, the International Civil Rights Center and Museum in the Woolworths building right there on Elm Street in Greensboro. And the woman who organized that show said, there are two people you have to meet. Now, what's interesting to me, became interesting to me in retrospect, was we had to leave that, you know, sanctioned, sanctified space of the Woolworths to walk about half a mile to the edge of downtown Greensboro and sit in a little cafe, and in walked Reverend Nelson Johnson and Joyce Johnson. And I didn't know anything about this history. And when they started to tell their story, I couldn't really believe that I didn't know. I thought, how is it possible that I don't know? This seems so significant. And then Nelson Johnson told a story that made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. He told a story about 9 years, something that happened 9 years after the shooting in 1979, when the Klan was going to march in Greensboro again. And he was then in seminary studying to be a pastor. And he decided that he needed to drive down and talk with them and ask them not to come to Greensboro, that it wasn't right for Greensboro for them to come.
Yeah.
And he got in the car and drove 70 miles out into rural North Carolina all by himself. And he passed through this moment of tremendous fear, and he called upon his faith to get through it. And he went, and he ended up meeting with some Klansmen and having a long, complicated conversation with them.
Yeah.
And at the end of that conversation, they promised that they wouldn't cause any trouble in Greensboro. But they couldn't say they wouldn't come because everyone knew they'd talk to him, and they didn't want the idea that a black man told them what to do or not to do to get around. And they did come to Greensboro, and no trouble took place there. But I heard that story and I thought, who is this person? Who are these people who, despite the trauma they've gone through, continue to face the world with hope and with courage and believing that every person could be transformed towards something better. And I thought, when I get a chance to write a, you know, take on a bigger project, I want to go down and spend some time with them and learn this history that I felt I should know and everyone should know, and also about who these people are.
Mm. That is powerful. That was one of the standout moments in the book for me. And number one, I was like, wow, what courage to, and before that, going to the residence. And then when he was meeting them, you know, they talked about people across, I think, what was it, a hotel, and people being across who could have taken him out. One wrong move, like things you just, wow. Just don't want to tell the whole story, but it just really, like you said, that was a really a standout in the book. There are so many significant points in there. You basically wrote about a painful chapter in our history, and it's still hard for many of us, and we're impacted by that history, right? Mm-hmm. Some may never heal, and then some of us still trying to live and get past that history. But what emotional responsibility did you feel towards the people who lived it? Like, was there an intent to make this somewhat therapeutic?
Well, I don't know if I could claim that I thought what I could do would be therapeutic to them, because they had been dealing and grappling with this history for so long on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But what I soon learned was, you know, when you suffer a trauma as big as a trauma like that, and unfortunately far too many people have suffered traumas like this.
Yeah.
It's raw for the rest of your life. You know, it is right there below the surface. And so I had a sense of that and realized that in order to get people to trust me and to be willing to talk with me, and I had to listen, I had to show empathy, I had to really just, in a sense, be present.
Yeah.
For whatever had to come out, and be gentle. And I think, you know, it's pretty obvious that that was important to the people who were the victims of this violence. But it actually applied surprisingly to people on a lot of different sides of this who carry the weight of what happened and the inability in some ways to explain it fully to themselves. It's still unsettled history.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, one of the things that I have felt is that this book has helped some of the people on their journey, you know, and has made it easier for them to talk about in some ways. And, you know, I had some of the people who are members of the Communist Workers Party with Nelson Johnson say, you know, I've never felt comfortable talking about this before. And now I feel like I can really talk about it. And to me, that is a huge honor that, you know, they trusted what I wrote enough to feel that they could begin to go out into the world with it in a different way.
Well said. Well said. And honestly, I don't think we'll ever move forward until we can have these discussions. So I commend you for creating the platform. And this book really opens the door and allows us to have that, share that story. My co-host, Tatiana, she has some questions before you came on. And she was curious to know about the research process, because I know you did an extensive amount of research. And like, how much time did you spend in the research and writing department on this project?
So I went down in January or February. I'm trying to think. It was January of 2017. Mm-hmm. And I sat down with the Johnsons and their friend and collaborator, Mr. Lewis Brandon. And I asked them, I said, would you let me in? Would you tell me these stories? Would you give me access to your archives? Would you introduce me to people and help me do the research so I can tell this story? And so they said yes. And this was, it took really about 7 years from that point to do the research and the writing. I, you know, in the fall of 2017, I sold the book to the Amistad imprint of HarperCollins. And I think I said to them, it'll take me 2 years. I blew through that by many times. And, you know, there was just so much to do and so much to understand. And it's so complex in some ways. And, you know, there are major archives at UNC. And, you know, if I had read every single page in that whole archive, it would have taken, I'd still be reading, you know, I'd still be there. And you had to figure out how to pick and choose and go through it. Yeah. Had to find people to interview, had to sort of win enough trust so they would let me interview them. And then I had to figure out what this all meant to me enough so that I could present it with confidence in the book, you know, and to know, trust what I felt that I knew after doing all this research. And so that really took a while. And then, you know, there was COVID in the middle of it. We had a son in the middle of it, my wife and I. So a lot of life came into this project too as it went along.
That is awesome. She also asked, was there one thing you learned about yourself through the publication process?
I learned so many things about myself. I feel like I'm, you know, I write to learn. You know, I write because I have questions. I write because I want to understand something about who I am and who the, in this case, what this country is and who these people are. So the whole process, really, from beginning to end and up and down and sideways, is about understanding and learning for me, and growing. Yeah. You know, one of the key things I learned as I sat with the Johnsons was they would say, we believe in the possible transformation of every human being. We believe in the possible transformation of every human being. And I would sort of ask them what this meant. And they really wanted me to respect the humanity of everyone I presented in this book. And I took that to heart, you know? And so I wanted to not, you know, make it simple, good guys against bad guys, or, you know, make someone's, hide someone's humanity behind their, the things that they did that weren't so good. I wanted to make sure they felt like full people. And I think that that's something that, one way their spirit lives in this book.
Yeah.
But to be honest with you, and I'll tell you one more thing, I came down there, I'm from Maine, I live in Virginia, and I thought, oh, this will be pretty simple. I'll just line up the facts and everyone will say, oh, that's what really happened. my naivete was in some ways a good guide through this, because it let me experience some of what I did in a very powerful and new way, so that I could really understand the social power that this story holds, and what different people have had to live through as they've carried the story.
Yeah. I will say, and I love what you touched on, what the Johnsons talked about transformation, because I really had pulled that out of the book, and that was going to be one of the questions. I didn't know that they kind of inspired that piece of it. But I know that some of the people in the massacre, you know, claimed they were misunderstood or provoked. And I thought you did this phenomenal job. You like, you balance empathy for them, like kind of really looking at it through their lens, because we all have layers where, you know, there's good and bad in all of us to a degree. And, but you were able to still spotlight the need for justice and accountability. And so it, you don't do that easily, and you really, it really shined throughout the book. So thank you for that. I know I touched on it in the beginning, but I'm not an expert. So I kind of gave a summary of the story. Is there anything you want to add before we move on? I should have asked that earlier, but I just want to make certain our listeners kind of understand what was going on in that time period and what occurred.
Yeah, no, you know, I mean, what's interesting and important, I think, about this time period, and a couple things worth mentioning about this, is one, that these activists, you know, who had recently decided to call themselves the Communist Workers' Party, first of all, it was a multiracial group. Mm-hmm. It was also a national group. I mean, this was the Greensboro group, or let's say branch, mm-hmm. if you will, of the Communist Workers' Party. But there were probably about 3,000 members of this all over the country in different cities. And what they were trying to do was go into factories, and in this case, textile mills, which were still some of the largest textile mills in the whole world. They hadn't been offshored yet. And build strength among workers to ask for health care, to ask for better working hours, to safer conditions, all of the sort of basic things that, you know, we say communism, but what are they actually asking for? You know, it's always important to me to return to what do the people want, and what are the workers asking for? And, you know, that day on November 3rd, 1979, five people died. One was an African-American woman. Two were Jewish men, doctors. One was an Anglo Divinity School student and medical school dropout. And one was a Cuban heritage PhD student at Duke. And I mention that because I think it's just important to understand, you know, the energy that was coming together across race and across culture to try to improve the lot of all poor people, and particularly minorities, but, you know, and try to bring poor people of different backgrounds together and working class people of different backgrounds together to make it more fair for everybody, you know? And I just think it's important to hold on to that aspect of what their mission was.
Amen. Amen. And you also wrote about justice being evaded despite the killings being caught on film. So in your own words, your opinion, what does that tell us about, what word am I looking for? The limits maybe of our justice system?
A couple things. I mean, you know, we like to think that our justice system is impartial and objective, but obviously we know that it responds to politics and culture and historical bias, and that we have to be constantly monitoring it to make it more fair for everybody. You know, what I learned, what was interesting to me was, so all the prosecutors and judges in the first two trials, which were a state murder trial in 1980, which was the longest at the time, longest state murder trial in North Carolina history.
Wow.
And then the federal criminal civil trial, which took place, a federal criminal civil rights trial, which took place in 1984. All of those prosecutors and judges were white, and they felt, I think, a great deal of social pressure about the fact that they were, particularly the prosecutors, in a sense, prosecuting on behalf of people that they did not feel comfortable with, right? Who called themselves communists, who were radical activists, who were multiracial, who were aggressive in their sort of statements about what they thought justice should look like. And it definitely influenced how they prosecuted the cases, I should say, to the point where when the federal civil trial took place in 1985, no North Carolina federal judge was willing to take the case. And so a judge from Richmond came down and presided over this case in Winston-Salem. And what that showed to me is the difference individuals who are righteous and principled can make in a legal proceeding. You had for the first time, the plaintiffs, in this case, the victims of the shooting, the activists, got to choose their own lawyers. And then this judge from Richmond, a man named Robert Marriage, who actually went to High Point College for a little while, but was from New York.
Virgin collard greens, squash and tomatoes, apples and okra and fresh sweet potatoes. $25 bags stuffed full of grub. These are the things at the Black Farmers Hub. Ooh, ooh. Onions and radishes, turnips and tamarind, turmeric and garlic and ginger's on hand here. Black beans, cucumbers, zucchini and hay. Let's not forget Nature's 360 Cafe. Fresh press juices, we've got smoothies, acai bowls too. From herbs to hoop cheese, the ones made locally, it's at the Black Farmers Hub.
But was from New York. Refused to let the jury strike the defense lawyers strike every Black person from the jury. They finally had a Black person on the jury for the first time. And the case was presented well. It was presented exhibiting the humanity of the victims. And for the first time, as far as I know, and perhaps only time in American history, Klansmen, American Nazis, a police informant, and police officers were found jointly liable for wrongful death. Yes. And that was the judgment.
Yeah. And it was a lot of lessons learned. It looked like from reading your book from the previous trial, from the criminal trial. And wow, I just kudos to you on this. I was trying to put my finger on it as I was concluding the book. I was like, what is it that stands out that makes it hard for me to put this book down? But one thing I will say, so many authors attempt to do this, I think, but you did it better than most. You were writing about real people, the traumatic events, but how did you navigate? Again, you did it well. How did you navigate that thin line between being a storyteller and a historian?
Well, you know, I am very interested in the craft of putting together a complex story, from the sentence to the paragraph to the chapter to the whole book. And this was a hard one to figure out because it ended up covering so much time.
Yeah.
And I had to work really hard at that, you know, but I wanted it to be accessible to people. I didn't want it to read in an academic way that excluded people who had lived, in a sense, this history. I wanted to make sure, you know, people who had lived through this history could pick up this book and get something out of it.
Yeah.
And so to me, they're two completely related jobs. One is to get the history right and do that, put the work in. And the other is to make sure that, you know, anyone can read it. And so that was part of my mission. I don't feel that history like this should be exclusive in any way. Yeah. I want it to be inclusive.
Thank you again. Something else, you said this book is more than 1979. It's about the America we keep choosing to be. So tell our listeners how that's relevant today.
What a great way to put it. You know, a recent reviewer from Durham said something I liked. He said that really the massacre in the book is almost like the prologue to telling the real story, which is the long quest to open up deeper equality, freedom, equity in America. And what I felt like I found in Nelson Johnson was this incredibly, and Joyce Johnson, yeah, were these incredibly courageous people who weren't going to be afraid of trying the different keys that presented to them to unlock the door, you know? And so they begin with King, and then they get involved in Black Power, and then they think about Pan-Africanism and maybe that freedom for Black people around the world should come from Africa over here. And then that leads them to communism. And then they move through in this extremely painful chapter of their lives, which includes this massacre, to a Christian theology and a sort of liberation theology. And which has a lot in common with some of what they believed in communism, but some important differences in terms of how they treat people right now, or think about people. And so I felt that this journey is one that obviously we're still on, and that I took so much inspiration from their perseverance, you know, from their willingness to keep looking at the world, redefining the problem, and trying to figure out what the right strategy and tactics were for figuring it out. And I thought, wow, what a great model and great inspiration for what we need to keep doing and be doing right now in particular.
Well said. If you could, because I'm thinking about our young people, and really when I read your book, I read, it's pretty objective in my opinion. You tell everyone's story, you're as fair as they come. But I know now we're in a world where political lines are pretty solid. But if you could speak directly to young activists today, like those who are fighting racial injustices, what lessons or warnings would you give them based on this story?
You know, one of the things that when I would go into the Beloved Community Center in Greensboro to talk with the Johnsons, Nelson Johnson, I think if he had a cell phone, it was a flip phone. And it rarely worked, or he rarely seemed to know how to answer it, which was just as well. And the thing that I felt being around him was that what sustained him, what kept him going, what gave him joy was community. And not online community, but real people community. And so I really, you know, I'm with him, spending lots of time with him from 2017 and with Joyce 2017 to 2024. And their lives were about real contact with real people. And that's how their organizing got done. And I think that that is a helpful lesson for young activists, is to go beyond Twitter, get out shoe leather, you know, shake hands,
yes,
commune with people. And also, this was very powerful. Be willing to talk to anybody. Just because you're talking to someone doesn't mean you have to agree with them. It doesn't even mean you do agree with them, but it means you're present. And one of the things that Nelson always said is walk toward each other. He didn't say necessarily walk toward each other and, you know, hug. But he said, walk toward each other. Try to find something that you can work with together. And I thought that was a great lesson. Like, instead of trying to find the thing that's the litmus test to keep you apart, find the thing that you can begin to use as a way to work toward each other as opposed to away from each other. And that was a lesson I really felt was profound and tried to take to heart as I worked on this.
That is a powerful lesson, because especially when you talk about social media, because not only is that part of the divide, but you talk about the misinformation. Man, you could go in so many. That's another episode, really. That's, yeah, thank you for sharing that. Tatiana also asked me to ask you this too, if you have any other books in the works.
Well, my first book was about an American from Ohio who fought in the Cuban Revolution. So I seem to be drawn to these revolutionary books. I'm back toward Latin America. And actually, I at some point would love to talk to you offline about this subject, but I came to it through my research for Morningside and discovered that a man named Josephus Daniels, now he was the Raleigh, is it Times and Dispatch? Is that right? What's the Raleigh newspaper?
The Raleigh Times.
He was the publisher and editor of that newspaper, and has a not a very good history there in North Carolina in some ways, because he was involved in stirring up the Wilmington Massacre in 1898. Mm. But he goes to Mexico and is the ambassador in Mexico for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and brings the good neighbor policy to Mexico. And it's actually a really interesting story. And I'm sort of thinking about taking that on and dealing with another complex character in Josephus Daniels and some of the work he did in Mexico.
Wow. I look forward. That sounds very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. So finally, I asked about our young people, but what do you want our readers or your readers to take away from Morningside?
You know, I heard this once and I thought it resonated with me. Someone said, you know, the civil rights movement, one of the tricks is getting away from the nine words, the famous nine words. It's Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, and I Have a Dream. And, you know, I think that one of the important things here is that the civil and human rights movements in the country are so much bigger than what we're generally taught. That history in this area doesn't stop in 1968, that it's not confined to just a few places, that there were so many more ideas about how to address the issues that were important than often get talked about.
Yeah.
And that richness is so, I find it so liberating to know that there were different kinds of people, very human people, accessible people that aren't necessarily on pedestals that you can model or learn from. And I mean, for example, Greensboro should be talked about in every discussion about the history of Black power in this country. I mean, it deserves a place, you know, with Detroit and Oakland and Chicago, New York. Greensboro was part of that important history. And so to me, even though I burrowed deep into a local story, this felt very much like a national story to me, and one that, you know, everyone could go and then dig into their local history and find the ways in which people resisted, you know, some of the white supremacy and some of the inequality in their towns, and find out that it was probably much more important than what we often realize. The other thing, you know, we've touched on this, is just the lifelong courage and commitment that the Johnsons show, it seems to me, are exemplary and worth holding up, you know, in times like this, because we feel in some ways like we're going backwards. And, you know, the Johnsons know about going backwards, but keeping walking. And so it feels like a story that is important to this moment.
Well said. I can just tell you, just listening to you talk about moving forward, the Johnsons, Greensboro being really, it was that was a national event. And for those of you, if you read the book, you'll find that there are some really standout figures in there that you read about before they even became famous, for lack of a better word. So powerful book. I always want to give this to our guests, the final word. Really make certain that you get to say everything that needs to be said, any events that are coming, any words of wisdom. I give you the floor. The floor is yours.
I just want to say, you know, I really appreciate the sensitivity you brought to reading the book and thinking about the people in the book. That I've done a lot of interviews about it now, but I feel like the way you centered the emotional parts and the human parts of this, hasn't really happened before. And I'm grateful for it, because that's something that really pulled me along as I tried to tell this story. And to that light, I just want to mention, you know, at one point, a couple months ago, a Greensboro police officer called me up. He just finished the book and he could barely talk because he was in tears.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, he said, I am so ashamed that I bought the line about who the Johnsons were. He said, I wish I had had my own head about me and stepped back and gone to meet them for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and now I can never meet Reverend Nelson Johnson because he's gone. And he was so upset, you know, and I thought, wow, well, that was one of the most powerful phone calls I've ever received after a book, you know, that it really did lead to his transformation. Anyway, I was honored that the North Carolina Humanities has picked Morningside for its statewide read for February of 2026. So I think there are going to be a number of virtual events in which people can hop on, and I'm going to be answering questions and perhaps other people who've been involved in this history. So it's a really exciting opportunity, I think, for people in North Carolina to learn even more about this history and perhaps to think about ways to bring it into their communities and engage around it, use it as a model to think about things in their communities that should still be talked about. Because every community, north, south, east, west in this country, has something it's got to talk about.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you again. And keep me posted. You and I really, I want to talk to you offline as well. There's a lot of things going on in this little brain. But Aaron Shetterly, we are so honored. We're thankful. We appreciate you more than you know. Look forward to the next work that you put out. And as always, you always have a place on the Unknown Preacher LA.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.